go.
And you're listening to the Rock of Appalachia, www.enlightenradio.org. And this is Resistance Radio every Wednesday at 10 a.m. from the Red Caboose in Bolivar, West Virginia, in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia. This is your host, Stuart Acuff. Great to have you with us. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for being here. And I'm joined, as every week, by my great friend and leader, John Case, the president, CEO, chairman of the board, and president of EnlightenRadio.org, and serving as, or working as he always does with us, as the engineer for Resistance Radio. Hey, John, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing good. I'm getting ready for a complicated Thanksgiving. I'm counting my blessings and curses, and I'm trying to see which way it ends up. But I just passed my 71st birthday, so
Happy birthday, brother.
Yeah, you know, and every day is gravy here as we head toward the pools of time.
Right. So. I have to say that I'm 62 years old, almost 63, as you know, and this is the first time in 62 years I've ever heard anybody refer to Thanksgiving as a complicated Thanksgiving.
I know, there's something in the air. I know, probably in 1939 there were some people saying that. I'm guessing, but not to draw too complicated to an analogy here.
Right. Well, you know, so now we're in this huge struggle over this tax plan scam, this so-called tax cut, which it turns out is only going to be cut taxes or the effects of taxes on the very richest amongst us, lowering the corporate tax rate from 35% down to 20% when the average corporation only pays about 18% in taxes now. Really raising the tax rate for people on the bottom. Why they would even bother to do that is it just shows the most disdain for the working poor. That you would raise the tax rate from, I think it's from 10% to 12% on the bottom rate, the bottom category. And essentially, no relief for what's left of the middle class. And in fact, you know, the horror of it is whatever it costs them to cut taxes for the rich and the corporations, they're going to claw back away from our Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Yeah.
And I just read yesterday that's what the law says. And so they have to offset what they cut, the amount they cut in taxes by taking away from not our taxes, but what we paid into Medicare and Social Security.
Was this the, I believe, the subject of the... looked like a kind of shouting match between Senator McCaskill and Senator Hatch over, what do you mean it's not going to cut Medicaid?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just because you force people off of it, that's not a cut, you know? I mean,
Right. Well, and then it goes, but it goes even worse, John, because, and thank God for Claire McCaskill. She's from one of my home states of Missouri, and she's a tough prairie legislator. I like Claire. She's pretty close to what she'd have to be to get elected statewide in Missouri these days. Didn't used to be that way. Used to be a much more progressive state than it is now. But it's even worse than that, because they're also going to cut the funds. Now, this is in the Senate side. It's not in the House version, but in the Senate version, McConnell's version, they're cutting the funds to pay the exchanges to give the insurance companies subsidies for insuring those that were just above the limit for Medicaid. And so they're cutting health care in two or three different ways, forcing people off Medicaid, and Claire's right about that. Two, clawing back funds from Medicare, and three, using the tax bill, the tax scam, as the cover and the vehicle to end the subsidies under Obamacare that made insurance affordable for working folks.
Right.
It's the biggest scam, and anybody who buys this shit is crazy. And people in West Virginia who still are loyal to Donald Trump and the Republicans, you know, what are they going to, how many of us are they going to have to kill before we realize they really don't have our best interests at heart, and they are willing to kill us to pursue their most narrow interests and their greediest goals? It's just unbelievable.
Well,
to me,
we've been debased by something,
right? And part of
reduced
it, John,
to a factional, very all these factional conflicts that are overwhelming common sense.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, in my view, part of it is it goes back to McConnell's obsession with Obama's success. And you know, it was right after the health care bill passed. I was at the Utility Workers Union at the time, chief of staff there, running their legislative operation. We were on board trying to pass the president's clean energy legislation.
Right.
That had already passed in the House as cap and trade. We had the votes. We had the votes to override the filibuster by the Senate Republicans. And as we were getting ready to go to the floor with it, McConnell said, "No more victories to this president." And Lindsey Graham pulled off of the clean energy bill right then. And that's why Obama had no more signature legislative achievements like the health care bill the rest of his two terms, because the Senate Republicans and the House Republicans just refused to support anything, no matter how important it was, no matter how good it was for the country. And that continues today. I cannot, John, I cannot think that a large part of what's driving Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans is just racism and resentment at Obama. And I wrote this little poem about it just the other day.
Oh, wow. Okay. Go for it.
How much do we all have to sacrifice to satisfy the racism of the GOP? How much hate does it take to risk the lives of Americans? The legislative legacy of Obama unmatched by Trump. McConnell will kill Obamacare to prove white supremacy. For us, white supremacy equals death. And I think that's the truth. Later in this this broadcast, I'm going to read another poem about the death cult that is the GOP now.
Oh my God.
Just because I'm overwhelmed every day at how much death, daily death of Americans, Republican leadership is willing to accept without doing a damn thing. The horrible mass murder, shooting after shooting, at one point almost day after day, you know, outrageous firearm death, the continued killing of black kids by unaccountable cops. I mean, the legislating death by trying, literally legislating death by doing everything they can to kill the only form of insurance available to the working poor now that that unions have lost so many members that they no longer can dictate the terms of the labor market, right. And unions can no longer dictate that workers, even without unions, get health care. Now the only option for most working Americans, is the Affordable Care Act, and if not Medicaid, the exchanges, the state exchanges, and now they want to take those away. It's beyond outrageous to me. It's beyond outrageous. It's just freaking crazy. John, you got a little song for this moment.
Yeah. You're down there, and you need something from Bob Marley saying to get up and stand up, right?
That's exactly right, brother. Okay. Let us have it.
All right, here she comes. All right, here you go.
Someone would say it's just love, and everyone would say everything. Let's move it.
John, you want to save that out?
Cause I never give up the fight.
Bob Marley, Marley brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors, Bob Marley here in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia. Welcome to Resistance Radio. This is Stuart Acuff and John Case coming to you from the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia, asking you today, call your senator. Democrat, Republican, does not matter. Same phone number, Capitol Hill switchboard, same phone number. Regardless of Democrat, Republican, whatever state you're from, that phone number is 202-224-3121. 202-224-3121. And let me just tell you that on this fight about this phony tax plan scam ain't a cut, is that the resistance here in West Virginia has been in motion all this week with demonstrations all across the state, including a great candlelight vigil here in Martinsburg, West Virginia, organized by Vigilance. And Dr. Bob Miller, your friend, John Case, Dr. Bob Miller. But all over the state, in Charleston, demonstrations as well, and all over West Virginia, and indeed across the country. See, while we ought to be giving thanks to the universe or our higher power or to Almighty God, while we ought to be giving thanks for the bounty of this nation, we're worried as a people because we stand to lose more and more and more. And this business of working people losing in this American economy and under this right-wing fascist leadership is very serious by now. And it is having a horrible effect on our whole nation. And the threat of war, the threat of fascism, the threat of losing democracy and freedom hangs over us in this season of Thanksgiving, so that the radical right punishes us all with their agenda. And it's what we're dealing with right now. But people in the resistance are dealing with it. We have slowed Trump down. We have created a swamp for him to try to get through, to get to his agenda. We are the resistance to Trump's agenda and to his fascism, and we are being successful simply by slowing the pace. And while we're at it, while we're talking about Thanksgiving, and John Case reminded me of this a while ago, John helped me say thank you for all of our resistance warriors here in West Virginia and around the country for all that you do every day.
Well, I think
no pay and not enough thank yous.
I feel like the people who at the last minute got Paul Revere's warning. Okay, and one by land, two by sea. It's time to get moving, people. And
yes.
And so I feel that way about the resistance people that took it on kind of from the Women's March on and in a big way. And it's been, they've been carrying the load, and it's having an impact. I think that's the main thing that's kept the Republican Party, which dominates all three parts of the government pretty much, from just ram it completely down our throats, although they're still trying. So, so I'm very thankful for those folks and their courage and sacrifice and willingness to put themselves in the way of the drain. And we need a lot more. To be nice to be able to get back at one of the houses of Congress so we could put a really giant log in front of the train.
That's right. Well, I've talking about getting back one of the houses of Congress, I've just committed to this, incredibly impressive young retired Army officer here in Martinsburg, Aaron Scheinberg, running for Congress against Mooney, running in the 2nd District of West Virginia.
Oh, he's
We're going to have some great candidates. This is going to be a great race here in West Virginia, a race we can win. And there's 2 Democrats in the race, and I'd be proud to support either one of them. But, you know, my backing right now is with Aaron. We can win this race here in West Virginia, and oh, what a huge difference that would make to win this 2nd District congressional race.
Right.
And it's right on top of us.
Okay, it's coming right up in 2018, correct?
Yep, that's exactly right. They're all coming in 2018. And talking about this resistance, I don't want to sound like I'm patting myself on the back, but one of the characteristics of social movement is that it creates its own art. And certainly, you know, that was true of the anti-war movement. The anti-war movement, and John knows more about this than I do, because he's older than me.
Approaching the pools of time.
I was 13 in 1968.
Right.
But how much incredible art did the anti-war movement create? From music, the most amazing music, to paintings, to visual art, to literature, great, great, amazing literature, to film, to every form of art imaginable came out of the anti-war movement. You were right there with it all the way, John.
Well, I felt that... You had the sort of counterculture movement, and remember, it was always very coincident with the civil rights upheaval of the 1960s.
Right.
There was a very close relationship to how things developed. When I was in school, and the uprising sort of I had 2 phases of getting involved in those uprisings, and one was in 64, and in Mississippi, and the other was in 68, 69 in Buffalo, and it was just, both of them had a profound impact on everything. It touched everything, and all the young people, if you weren't into one of them, you were in the other, and if you were in the civil rights movement following Dr. King's assassination and the extermination plan that the FBI launched against the Black Panther Party, maybe recall that, they'd had a, and then the militancy of the anti-war demonstrations as the war became just more and more unwinnable, and as Nixon became even more weird.
Intransigent.
It started to fall apart. And maybe we've never fully recovered from the wound that was inflicted. I'm not sure we have.
And thank you for that, John. And I've been thinking about sort of the art that came out of it. And you're right about the overlap with the civil rights movement. But the civil rights movement had its own separate piece too. You know, the whole Memphis Sound, Stax Records, was about the civil rights movement in the South, that either empowering people or representing people or creating culture for people who were in some ways being recognized for their own sake of humanity, for their own humanity's sake. I've been trying to write for 100 years not achieving anything particularly good, and I've been writing pretty seriously for the last few years, trying to write poetry. And one of the things that this gives me some reason to put poems out there that I'm not certain if they're very good or not, is that, you know, maybe we're creating some resistance art. And maybe there's a cumulative effect that the more people who engage it, the better that art becomes. I don't know. I have no idea. But
so it's like the maybe so, like the mural movement of the 1930s and 40s.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And so I was I'd written a poem which I'm going to read in a little bit that I felt like was good, and got it out there over the weekend. I think Sunday, and maybe Saturday. I don't remember. And this guy commented. It was on Facebook. He said, "Man, that's great." And I said, "Well, you know," I wrote back, "Thanks. It means a lot." That. And he said, "I'd like to collaborate with you." Well, turns out, John, that this guy is a very successful, great painter.
Wow.
And a former ACORN organizer, like I am. And he's
You got a link there, buddy.
So he's known about me for a long time, right?
What kind of painter is he? Does he have a specialty of any kind, or portraits?
He paints organizer paintings.
He paints organizer paintings. Okay, man.
People in action.
Oh,
and so his idea was and is for us to do a book together connecting his paintings with my poems, so they sort of mirror one another.
Now, does he think you would write some poems to his painting, or he would paint to your poem, or new stuff, or stuff you've already done?
You know,
or
we're going to start with what we already have, because he's got 2,000 paintings, and I've got 500 poems, and I probably feel pretty good about 150.
Right.
You know, 50 have been published.
Right.
I generally, anything that gets published, I think, well, somebody besides me thinks it's good, so I kind of get that validity and credibility.
Right.
And then there are some other ones that, for whatever reason, haven't been published, but, you know, have some value. But so we talked about it, decided to do it. I called an acquaintance of mine, a buddy of mine, Sunday morning in New York City. And this guy was a shop steward and workplace activist in 1199. He was a janitor at one of the big hospitals, private sector hospitals in New York City. But he wrote novels. He wrote mysteries. And he retired, I think, 3 years ago and started his own little publishing house.
Wow.
And he bought it. He bought the idea immediately. He knows, he's read both of my books, and he's used my first book. He used my first book in a class that he was teaching. So he knew what he was buying when buying, you know, my writing.
He'd looked into your stuff, and he was really a knowledgeable collaborator. Okay, that's cool.
Right. Yeah. So the publisher says you don't have to raise the money. I know we're not going to make any money. Of course, you don't make any money with poetry. Not, you know, if you're writing poetry to make money, you're in the wrong field. He says, all you got to do is show me a plan for selling enough books in the first year to pay back my initial costs. And when you demonstrate that, I'll send you a contract. Isn't that great?
That's wonderful. It's great. Well, that means the publisher must want to, you know, get some of that stuff out there. Maybe find out if there's a market for it now. You know, that's a good,
find
a good
out
sign.
If there's a market. Find out if
it's a good sign.
Yeah, find out how if other people think it's got value.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right, cool.
And the painting will only help it.
You're on your way. The next Steinbeck is. Getting ready here.
Right.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean. You just got to keep at it, I suppose.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, you just got to keep at it, and why not? And,
right.
Maybe at the end of the line, you know, the thing, your kids come to collect your fortune, and there's this, you know, couple of thousand page book, you know, that's be like Emily Dickinson stuff. But.
Right.
Right, you know, in the closet.
You know, they're damn sure ain't going to be any money when my kids come to collect their fortune.
Well, but you never know down the road. I mean, like Emily's poetry, she never made a dime off of it, I don't think. You know, so, but
right.
Now she's the...
She wrote it all on the backs of envelopes and stuff, right?
Well, a lot of it, apparently, right? I mean, there's a lot of it. That wasn't our friend from the college one time talking about that, how she had...
Oh, yeah. That's how I know that.
Yeah. She was about how she had, it was sometimes hard to tell what was the second verse and what was the third verse in the poem.
Hey, John, can you give me a time check, please?
Yes, you're at, well, you're at, hold on. You're at 35 minutes into the hour.
35 minutes, that's great. Hey, and since we paused to take a little time check, let me thank you for tuning in with us, for being with us today on Resistance Radio. This is Stuart Acuff, your host, and John Case, President, CEO, Chief Operating Officer of EnlightenedRadio.org. Last night, John, we had this great vigil, candlelight vigil, at actually tonight, we're having this great candlelight vigil at Capito's office, and speaking, and I've been identified as from Enlightened Radio.
Oh, well, that's very nice.
Host of Resistance.
There you go.
Resistance Radio.
That's right. Don't forget to tell them the time,
cool, huh?
Even though it wasn't the time today.
Well,
I mean, don't forget to tell them the time. Okay, so.
Right. Right.
Well, I mean, it's been working out a little bit that the early show, it turns out, the listenership is sort of going up a little bit, and I noticed that, and then, because I started to get phone calls about, you know, there's little kids listening when you're...
you know, somebody's listening.
Yeah, right, anyway, so I said, well, okay, we'll try to use code words, you know, like Ford and things like that. Okay, so...
So this, I'd like to play this next song now. When we come back from this song, I'm going to read this other poem that is going to be probably featured in the new book coming out. By the way, the publisher wants the book out by next April, John. Isn't that exciting?
Okay, springtime. Springtime.
Yeah, springtime.
Remember that song, Springtime for Hitler in Germany?
Yeah.
It was part of the producers,
right.
That old movie.
Right.
But we're going to...
I'm sorry.
We're going to try to turn that into a real farce that it should be, hopefully, by springtime. And if the resistance keeps moving, we can... Jerry Brown says that once you make something look absurd enough, you can defeat it.
So. I think that's right. I absolutely think that's right. Anyway. But let's... I want to play this next song. This is one of my favorites from The Boss. This is No Retreat, No Surrender, and this has got to be our attitude right now.
Okay, bud.
Baby, no surrender. When our young faces grow sad and old, and hearts of fire grow cold, we swore blood brothers against the wind. Now I'm ready to grow young again and hear your sister's voice calling us home across the open yards, believing we could cut some place of our own with these drums and these guitars. As we made a promise we saw we'd always remember. No, a tree, baby, no surrender. Blood brothers on a summer's night with a vow to defend. No, a tree, baby, no surrender. Tonight the lights are growing dim. The walls of my room are closing in. But it's good to see your smiling face and to hear your voice again. Now we could sleep in the twilight by the riverbed, with a wide open country in our hearts and these romantic dreams in our heads. As we made a promise we swore we'd always remember. No, a tree, baby, no surrender. Blood brothers on a summer's night with a vow to defend. No, a tree, baby, no surrender. No, a tree, baby, no surrender.
Wow, what a great song. What a great, great song. Thank you all for being with us today on Resistance Radio. This is the Rock of Appalachian, the Blues of the Blue Ridge. Your host, Stuart Acuff, and John Case. John is president, CEO, and all-around leader of EnlightenRadio.org. Of course, that was No Retreat, No Surrender by the boss, Bruce Springsteen.
And the, John, East, you know, and the E Street Band. And the E Street Band as well.
And the E Street Band.
Yes, right. So,
I'm, by the way, I'm getting that echo again.
Now you're getting an echo.
No, it just left. It just stopped. That's weird. I don't know.
I don't
but anyway,
know
most of our listeners don't know this, but I have the name of that song, No Retreat, No Surrender, tattooed on my upper right arm.
You
kind of a little message to myself, a little reminder to myself.
Well, I didn't know that. Yes, I did know that.
Yeah,
I did know that. Yes, I did. Okay.
You see me swimming in the rivers with my kids, and
that's true. I think, right.
Rafting down the rivers, yeah.
But was that from the song, or was that after? I mean, after you heard the song?
I had, as I recall, Springsteen came out with "Born in the USA." That was this album, and it was his first album that I didn't really like, but I loved this song, I think George Bush had just been elected president. And so it sort of took the last deniability away from, well, maybe it's not as bad as we think it is. Maybe it's just because Reagan is so personally popular.
Yeah.
And then when, you know, George Bush got elected with the same agenda, but not nearly as much charm.
Yeah.
All the deniability was over, and so I,
so true.
A lot of people faced a kind of an existential crisis at that moment. Well, what is the point? What am I doing? And what does this mean for how I live and for the rest of my life? And as an organizer, I think all of us who were, you know, had committed our lives to trying to pursue social, economic, racial justice, faced a kind of an existential crisis. And in my typical West Tennessee fashion, I saw my existential crisis with a damn tattoo.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, right. Hey, I'm going to put a label on this. And
right, right. Hey, you got a question about how I'm living my life? Read this shit, pal.
I'm carrying a sign right now. Yeah, that's right. Well, I know.
Yeah. So I want to read this this poem. It's a little bit longer. It's not a long poem, but it's kind of a wail. Deep in the eternal night of moonlit meadows, ghostly trees, stars piercing the deep indigo blanket, you might finally see what we have become and what more we can become. The lame leaders who now simply ignore mass shootings and black kids killed by unaccountable cops and deepening poverty everywhere and hungry kids and stagnant wages and no future, death by despair and the epidemic of nihilism and no answer to anything worth asking. And leave her the hell alone, asshole. And yes, it is that bad as you feared in bright light, as if America is struggling and staggering out loud in the open with the demons of millions of whippings and lynchings and rapes and burned villages and the trail of tears and women and children enslaved and Fannie Lou Hammer at the 1964 Democratic Convention and Dr. King on the balcony in Memphis watching James Orange. And we are what we got now. No one else but us, we who love America, just as did Douglas and Debs, Du Bois, Brown, Truth, Harvey Milk, Reuther, Randolph, Caesar, Dr. King.
Wow. That's quite a, you know, I think you need a trumpet. I'm not kidding.
I was thinking about a Coltrane wail on a tenor sax.
Okay, but I mean, I think a wail, yeah, but I mean, maybe. Well, okay, yeah, I can see it either way. That's true. I mean, just yeah. Is it a blues or is it a, is it, remember that scene in Braveheart where Mel Gibson is riding back and forth in front of his guys and freedom, you know, one of those.
Right.
It could be one of those death-defying things.
That would be awesome. Thank you, John. Thank you for saying nice things.
Well, I'm just saying a trumpet, man. Which I felt a trumpet, you know, sound in the.
Right.
I did.
Right.
You know, thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. So this is a trying time for all of us, but it is not any more than the people of this country have shown in the past that we can bear and, in fact, overcome. And, you know, I refer a lot to our what Howard Zinn called the people's history of the United States. I call it kind of the real history or the grassroots history of the United States. And the real history of the United States is simply this struggle from before there were states and before they were united for greater freedom and democracy and the expansion of freedom and democracy from white men of privilege to more and more, including more and more of us all the time. And that's really the essential struggle of America, and it's the essential, I think, character of America. Not without deep and serious flaws, not without twists and turns, and sometimes a twisted heart, but ever trying to expand the dream of America, which is freedom, democracy, and justice. Now it's our chapter in this history. And some of us, like John and myself, are sort of post our working lives. We're both retired. And certainly in my case, I'm past my my peak energy and physical stamina. But there are still lots of things that people like John and me can do, and more that people who are younger and stronger and newer in this struggle can do. The point is that it's up to all of us to do what we can do within the context of our lives and our circumstances and situations, to do what we can do to defend democracy in America. And it really is something that we have to take personally. It really is a personal obligation and responsibility that was passed on to us by the foremothers and forefathers, by the people who were sacrificed for freedom and democracy. And there's, you know, it's not like we can avoid it. It's not like we can choose to not engage. This is our place in history to engage this. And that's what we're doing. And that's why, in the end, we're going to win, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors. We are going to win. And you heard it here first on The Rock.
Hopefully not last. Hopefully not last. I hope you hear it. You know, it's like somebody was commenting upon the woman who I believe was driving in a car or on a bike, riding a bicycle or something, as the Trump motorcade passed, and she flipped the bird. And then, you know, he came after her. They did something.
Got her fired.
Got her fired and stuff like that.
They got her fired. Yeah.
And my thought was, you know, let 100 million birds be flipped.
Right.
That was my
sense. I don't know, John. You know, I was an organizer for a long, 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 long time, and I still got a lot of street in me. So I just see a lot of this bizarro stuff that Trump does, like from the prism or the perspective of the street. And when I see him do something like that, I think, what a punk. What a punk.
Yeah.
You're the president of the United States, and you can't suck it up when somebody flips you off, so you got to go get that person fired.
Yeah.
What a tiny little man. What a just a kid. What an emotional midget he is.
They say that Marcos in the Philippines was like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Pinochet.
Yeah.
He was like that.
That's the way authoritarians are.
I mean,
yeah. So, John, I'm going to get ready to go to Washington D.C. in the morning to meet with the artist, the painter. His name is Mitchell Klein, who's going to be my collaborator on this book. Ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors, brothers and sisters, think about whether or not you can host a poetry reading from us next spring and summer.
Oh, yeah.
And fall. And do something today. Call your senator. call Shelley Moore Capito if you're from West Virginia. 202-224-3121. Tell her no on the tax plan scam. No on the tax plan scam. John, can you take us out of here with a little bit of Jackson Browne or something like
that? Oh, yeah.
On
right. That's what we'll be doing after they take all the money out of our pocket.
Hey, it's the truth. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. We love you across the Eastern Panhandle, across America, and around the world here on Resistance Radio. Stuart Acuff and John Case.
All right, man.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Bye-bye.
Okay, it's coming up.
Thank you. Yeah, we can make it work. Musicians can make it work. Every time. So we better get up, stand up for your rights. Or someone